Tangeman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
This is a petition for further review. And Ms. Mooney, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Tangeman, then you may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska. This Court granted the State's further review of the decision of the Court of Appeals. The State submits that the District Court's judgment denying post-conviction relief should have been affirmed and that the Court of Appeals erred by finding trial counsel ineffective in ordering a new direct appeal. Pursuant to a plea agreement with the State, the defendant pled guilty to two reduced counts of possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. He was ultimately sentenced to consecutive prison terms of 6 to 8 years on each count. No direct appeal was filed. 6 months following sentencing, the defendant filed a motion for post-conviction relief alleging one claim. Trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file a direct appeal when the defendant told counsel to do so. An evidentiary hearing was held on that claim, and the district court rejected it on the merits, finding that trial counsel was not ineffective because the defendant did not instruct counsel to file a direct appeal. The court stated in its order that it found trial counsel's testimony more credible than the defendant's testimony. The Court of Appeals found that, as the fact finder, the district court did not err in finding that the defendant failed to instruct his trial counsel to file an appeal. The court then went on to find that, although the record established that trial counsel spoke to the defendant numerous times about an appeal, trial counsel's performance was deficient because counsel did not specifically consult with the defendant about an appeal following the sentencing hearing. The State's position is that the judgment of the district court should have been affirmed once the Court of Appeals found that trial counsel did not disregard a specific instruction to file a notice of appeal. This was the sole claim presented to the district court. There were no allegations before the district court that trial counsel never consulted with the defendant regarding an appeal or that counsel was ineffective
for... Is consultation just a part of asking counsel directly to appeal?
I view it as two different claims. I think that when you have a claim here that I told my counsel, I urged him to file an appeal and he refused to do so, implicit within that is that there has been some consultation of an appeal. There was no assignment of error, no allegations in the post-conviction motion that counsel never told me about an appeal, that I didn't know I couldn't appeal, but that I told him to do so and he didn't. So the State's position is that implicit within that is that there was some type of consultation.
What is consultation in this context? I mean, does it have a specific meaning?
Yeah, it has been defined, I don't know if I have the exact words here, but talking about the advantages, the disadvantage of appealing and determining, you know, somewhat of the defendant's interest. I know it's defined.
But at least part of the idea, right, is determining the defendant's wishes. Does the defendant want to appeal?
Yes, that is true.
So there could even be some inconsistency between my counsel disregarded my instructions claim and my counsel didn't consult with me claim, right? I mean...
Yeah, yes, I think so. I think the claim here, though, is that I made it crystal clear. I urged him, I pleaded with him to appeal, and he refused to do so.
Is this... What is the issue? An alleged pleading failure? Or is it a failure of proof?
I don't think there's an alleged... I don't know how to explain it exactly, but the analysis of the Court of Appeals went beyond what was pled, what was the issue beyond the district court. When you look at the district court's order, it focused on the sole issue. Did you or did you not tell your counsel to appeal? That was the end of the story. The Court of Appeals addressed that and found that incorrect, but then went on to impose additional requirements of defense counsel in this case to consult with him specifically after sentencing. There was no type of assignment of error, no type of allegation in his post-conviction motion that counsel did not provide me appropriate consultation following sentencing, that counsel did not communicate with me following sentencing. And so I think the Court of Appeals took it beyond the issue that was presented below.
Did the Court of Appeals have to find its own facts to get where it got?
It basically found that the record was not sufficient to address the facts that they felt it needed to be addressed in order to find the counsel wasn't deficient. It said the record does not tell us this, the record does not tell us that. Well, the reason that the record does not tell us those things is because consultation was not the issue. The issue was solely, did you tell him to file a direct appeal or not?
So in answer to Justice Miller Lerman's question, there is at least a failure to correctly plead.
In terms of where the Court of Appeals went with it, yes. Yes. The state views it essentially as two different types of claims, because if the defendant hadn't been consulted, his assignment of error, his allegations in his post-conviction motion would have been, I didn't know I had a right to appeal. My counsel never talked to me about an appeal. I didn't know my options with an appeal, as opposed to, I told him to appeal and he didn't do so. So that is where the state believes that the relevant allegation, the only one presented to the district court, was refuted by the trial court's deposition testimony, and as a result, the Court of Appeals should have affirmed the judgment.
Is there support for that theory?
For
the theory that you can't switch horses kind of in the middle of the race?
Yes, I mean, I think this court's opinion in State v. Dalton dealt with it a little bit about how there was no allegations regarding further communication that was not presented. I think it just comes down to general post-conviction type of case law, that this court and the lower appellate court should not be addressing any type of issue that was not presented to the district court. This court and the U.S. Supreme Court has never imposed on trial counsel a requirement to consult with the defendant concerning an appeal at a specific point in a criminal proceeding. Thus, the state believes it was error for the Court of Appeals to impose such a requirement on defense counsel in this case, especially given the fact, as I have already said, the defendant did not allege ineffective assistance for failing to specifically consult with him following sentencing. That, I would say, is the state's overall position. If for some reason this court would agree that there was some deficient performance regarding consultation, I would also note that I raised in our petition for further review that we did not agree with the prejudice analysis given by the Court of Appeals. I do not think the defendant in this case can show any non-frivolous grounds for appeal based on this court's decision in State v. Wagner, and also that any type of Blockberger claim would have been waived by the pleas that he entered in this case.
Under Flores-Ortega, does the defendant have to show a non-frivolous ground to appeal, or is there another way you can show prejudice in a failure to consult claim?
Well, the prejudice is that he would have appealed but for counsel's deficient performance, and so along with that, it's going to be relevant, would a reasonable defendant in the defendant's position, and so that is where you get into the non-frivolous issues.
Is it would a reasonable defendant, or is it would this defendant?
Both, I think. I believe the U.S. Supreme Court talks about either or. If defense counsel knew that this specific defendant wanted to appeal, or they didn't talk about it, but he knew a reasonable defendant, you know, we're talking a plea-based case here, but obviously if you have a two-week-long jury trial, it's a different type of situation, and a reasonable defendant in something like that is going to want to appeal.
The consultation analysis might be different, and the prejudice analysis might be different in a non-plea-based case.
Yes. Unless this court has any additional questions, we would ask that you reverse the opinion of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mooney, good morning again.
Good morning.
And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, opposing counsel, I'm Sarah Mooney, and I represent the appellant Marvell Ammons in this appeal. We argue here this morning that the Court of Appeals opinion should be affirmed in this appeal. It is our position that Mr. Ammons had a very specific fact scenario different from the more recent post-conviction cases that the Nebraska appellate courts have reviewed. And based upon that, we believe that the opinion should stand. As you heard from the state, they are arguing that once you find that Mr. Ammons did not direct trial counsel to file a direct appeal, that is the end of the analysis. However, I would point the court to several different cases that have been heard by the Nebraska appellate courts, and I believe the Supreme Court, where when the defendant or the appellant has just alleged that he was not informed of his right to counsel, or excuse me, of his right to appeal, that the Roe analysis was still interpreted by the courts. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals reasoning was in their opinion. At oral argument, the state argued that according to State versus Russell, since Ammons knew about his appeal rights, that you don't get to Roe. Now, in their petition for further review, they're saying it's based upon the fact that it was not pled in the pro se motion that was filed by Mr. Ammons. And the Court of Appeals agreed that you can still find prejudice and deficient performance under Roe, even if the defendant just pleads that it was failure for his counsel to file a direct appeal.
Was the failure to consult pled in the post-conviction motion?
It was not. It was just that, I mean, at the time Mr. Ammons filed his motion, he believed that he had directed trial counsel to file an appeal. We're talking about dealing with, you know, COVID-19, a pandemic. I think, you know, the facts of the case were, he talks about that a lot in his deposition, that there was a period of time where he was trying to get in contact with his attorney.
How about during the evidentiary hearing? Did evidence come into the record where he made allegations of failure to consult?
His deposition said that he was not consulted with, after the sentencing hearing, there was no more conversation with his attorney about an appeal. I think in the deposition, Mr. Ammons said that the only time that he talked about an appeal with his attorney was when he said, by entering a plea here today, am I giving up any rights that I would have at an appeal? During the deposition testimony that was offered at the evidentiary hearing from trial counsel said, I discussed with Mr. Ammons about an appeal when he signed the fee agreement, telling him that this would not cover anything beyond the representation. It would not cover an appeal or a post-conviction. And then he also agreed that he spoke with Mr. Ammons at the time of the plea, saying, okay, by entering a plea here, you're not giving up any rights to an appeal.
Is it fair to say that the district court did not rule upon a failure to consult issue?
I think that that was part of the issue, because if you look at district court Judge Durr's order, he talks about Roe. I mean, he cites that. I don't think he elaborates it on to the point.
Does he make findings about whether there was a duty to consult? Does he make findings about whether consultation took place?
No, I think he just basically talks about, he does kind of a blurb about Roe and the reasonableness test, but I don't think he applies it to the facts.
He doesn't apply it to the facts.
No, he does not.
So what did the Court of Appeals have to review then?
Well, I think the facts...
With respect to failure to consult.
Well, when I filed my assignment of error, I said that it was an error for trial counsel not to file an appeal. And then when we did the briefing and stuff, I cited to Roe versus Flores-Ortega because I think it expands upon that. I don't think, if you look at Roe, when the defendant in that case made his allegations for ineffective assistance of counsel, he didn't say it was from a failure to consult. He said it was a failure of trial counsel to file an appeal. So the analysis still continued with that about the failure to consult, even though Roe didn't allege that in that case. So I guess I don't see, if you're going to apply Roe, why you're going to put an additional requirement on this defendant that wasn't required of Roe.
Did the Court of Appeals say, in effect, the law is an allegation of failure to file an appeal necessarily and naturally includes a failure to consult?
Basically what they said, if you cannot tell from the record, if you cannot find that, first, basically what they said was, okay, Mr. Ammons said that he tried to get in contact with his attorney. He also had his wife try and get in contact with his attorney. Then trial counsel testified in his deposition that he did not get any messages, he did not get the letter, he did not receive the information.
I'm kind of back where I was with Ms. Tangeman. I think when I said, is this a failure of allegations or a failure of proof?
Well, I don't think that there was a need to allege that this was a failure of consultation, because I think if you apply Roe, that does not need to be alleged in the motion. I think you can still go through this reasonableness test of whether or not it's reasonable for an attorney to go and consult with a defendant about an appeal can still be applied. It just by saying there was a failure to file an appeal. I don't think you have to allege that in the motion.
Didn't the motion allege I told my attorney to file an appeal?
It did.
So you're saying that every time someone makes an allegation that I told my attorney to file an appeal and he didn't or she didn't, that necessarily includes the lawyer didn't consult with me?
Look, if you apply the analysis to Roe, I believe so, yes, that you need to look and see. It's not a bright line rule where it needs to go with every single case. I think you need to apply this reasonableness test that's set forth in Roe. And when he filed the motion, he was basing it on the fact that he believed that he had taken the steps to advise his attorney that he wanted an appeal. I mean, he testified that he sent a letter. He testified asking about an appeal, wanting to direct his attorney to file an appeal. He had his wife contact on two separate occasions as well. So I think at the time that he took the deposition, he believed that he had taken the steps that he needed to advise his counsel that he wanted an appeal.
Federal constitutional law does not govern Nebraska's post-conviction pleading statute, does it?
Well, I think that you should, if there's a U.S. Supreme Court case and it's been used and cited to in other state Supreme Court cases, including the Nebraska Appellate Court case, I think we can apply those principles and look at that test.
You're answering a different question than what I asked. I certainly agree that post-conviction is designed to provide a remedy when someone has been deprived of a federal or state constitutional right. But the constitutional rights involved are the substance. They don't govern the pleading requirements, do they?
Well, I mean, according to when I looked at the motion to file a post-conviction, I think that falls under the civil. It's a civil matter.
You have to allege what was done that deprived you of a federal constitutional or state constitutional right, correct?
Yes, that's true.
And here, he didn't allege failure to consult. He alleged, I told him to appeal and he didn't appeal. Isn't that the nub of what happened?
That is what is set forth in the motion, yes.
Okay.
But I don't think that that's the end of the analysis if you look at the cases. I don't think that it is. And
if
I also think
that...
If
this was a pro se filing, does that make any difference to us?
Well, I mean, they don't get the advice of counsel until after the evidentiary hearing is granted. In regular cases, if I had a private client come in and want to file a post-conviction motion, or if they have retained counsel after they filed a motion for post-conviction, it can be amended. But once the evidentiary hearing was granted, we were confined to the motion that the pro se defendant filed, yes.
It's not uncommon for appointed counsel to ask to amend the post-conviction motion, though.
Not after an evidentiary hearing is granted. But typically, it's not.
Between the time that the hearing is granted and the hearing is held.
Well, but in Douglas County, we don't get appointed until after the hearing is granted.
Is there a non-frivolous ground to appeal, and does it matter?
Well, if you look at Roe versus Flores-Ortega, it says that it doesn't have to be non-frivolous, it has to be non-meritorious. And I would agree with what the Court of Appeals said in here, that, you know, to expect a pro se defendant who hasn't had the advice of counsel to set forth in their post-conviction motion what their grounds for appeal would be prejudicial to the defendant.
Well,
so,
he's not pro se any longer.
Well, at the time that he filed.
Sure,
motion,
but what,
yes.
what's he going to appeal?
Well, what he put in his motion was that he was going to appeal, obviously, the consecutive sentencing, and then he was also going to appeal the whole position of him being essentially convicted and sentenced twice on the same crime. And so, because it was two counts of essentially being a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. And so the Court of Appeals found that he might not be meritorious on those claims, but they're not frivolous.
And that's your position here today, they're not frivolous?
Correct. I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
59 seconds, Your Honor.
59
seconds. Always, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Tangeman. Ms. Mooney, you were appointed in this matter.
I was.
Thank you for your service. Counsel, you are excused. And the court will proceed with Lincoln County Board of Equalization versus Western Tabor Ranch Apartments. Justice Funk is recused in this matter. Judge Lee will read. Excuse me. Rejoin the court.